Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 93 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And today's going to be a cantina conversation between our book reviewer, Megan McCarthy-Bianc, and a return author, which is Daniel Krause.
Yeah, Megan's been putting in work with these book reviews and booking authors for us. We have a bunch of upcoming cantina conversations regarding her book reviews. And thankfully, Daniel Krause will not stop writing this year. He's just putting out book after book in 2020, which is good for him. And he's using our platform as a way to let our audience know about his work. So we greatly appreciate Mr. Krause for coming on the show and giving us his time. We all know that time is a valuable thing. And yeah, we can't thank him enough for coming on the show.
Yeah, and he talks about how busy this year was within the episodes. You'll hear how he had, I think it was four books releasing this year, four works to promote, and it's not easy to do that in 2020. But this one specifically that they spend this episode talking about is a book coming out on August 4th. You can pre-order it now on Amazon or any other bookseller, and it's The Living Dead, which this is a special thing for him in the sense that he is following up and completing the works of George A. Romero, who created the zombie genre. And through this book, he talks in this interview about how it came to be that he was asked to complete the works for the late George A. Romero, who this completes his saga, which he was never going to be able to do in film. This specific story was never going to make it to a film, was never going to get the budget needed to make this. So George Romero, who's known for his movies, started writing this book, never completed it. And then years later, Daniel Krause was asked to finish this, which he was honored to do so. And he talks about, and you can hear how much he respected the work of George Romero in this interview.
Yeah, it was a really good interview. He already came on for his previous book this year during C2E2 for Ben Tevins, and he's rolling out a few more. And thanks to COVID, book tours have been shut down, and he's having to rely on people like us to promote his work. So we're going to take advantage of the COVID situation and enjoy the time we have with Mr. Krause. So with all that said, here's Megan and Daniel Krause.
We're here today with Daniel Krause. Got a tons of published works under your belt. Today we're talking about The Living Dead, that you worked with George A. Romero's estate. But thank you so much for taking the time out. It's great to see you again. I know the last time we talked was back before the world was on fire. So, yeah. I'm glad to see that you've been staying healthy, both physically, mentally, hopefully all of that good stuff, and just powering through, because I understand that releasing a new project can be a crazy time in and of itself. And so just throw in like a global pandemic and all this stuff, I imagine, has kind of thrown a wrench into things on top of it.
Yeah. I mean, try four projects. This was kind of my big year. I had four books essentially coming out in 2020, which is crazy. And Bent Heavens came out like a week before the pandemic really hit here.
Yeah.
So it's been, I picked the wrong year, I guess.
Or maybe you picked the right one. If everybody had a lockdown and needed something to do or needed, a new form of stress relief, maybe. Because I think I follow you on social media and I see, you're reposting a lot of reviews of people's of The Living Dead, and they're saying oh my God, how relevant this is to what's current events. And yeah. So I think it's kind of funny how it ended up, even though maybe you think oh my God, why did this year have to, have to coincide with all these projects? Yeah. Maybe it was okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. It's, yeah. We're living in Romero times right now.
Yeah, I know, right? On top of that, so I read, I did read the author's note at the end, but just for our audience, kind of walk us through the process, what was going through your head when, this project came, kind of came up, and how long the process took, and mm-hmm. any kind of, how you were forced to kind of almost change maybe most of your process from how you're used to doing it from your published works in the past.
Yeah. I don't think I'll really ever have a project that functioned like this one did. It was a unique situation. As far as sort of my mindset when it happened, I was kind of beside myself. I really still am. You know, George Romero was my absolute hero from a very young age. That's amazing.
That's so exciting for you. Yeah.
Yeah, it really was. As I have said many times before, excuse me, Night of Living Dead was really the first film I remember seeing as a little kid. I mean, undoubtedly there were some cartoons or Disney movies in there somewhere, but I don't remember that. But I remember being very young, 5 or 6 years old or something like that, and seeing Night of the Living Dead, or at least pieces of it. My mom was a big horror fan, and so that was always on because of the copyright issues with Night of the Living Dead. It was always on TV.
Okay.
And that and Twilight Zone. I my mom was always watching those. And as I got a little older, I would stay up with her, I don't remember, Friday nights or something, and watch Twilight Zone. So I really grew up with Rod Serling and George Romero. So, you know, his films really guided a lot of my life and certainly my artistic inclinations. And I became a great student of his, not just his zombie works, but all of his films. I was a real acolyte in a lot of ways. Getting the call from his manager and wife to see if I was interested in working on this project was just a tremendous shock and surprise. I sort of knew that the project existed every once in a while. I mean, I think George is working on it for a on and off for like a decade or so.
Right, right.
Every once in a while, I think an interview would sort of mention it. You know, he'd mention he's working on a book. And I didn't know much about it, but it was out there that he was toying around with a book somewhere. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't know it was in any kind of...
But you had like met him once or twice before, right?
Yeah. I'd met him before, but not in any kind of real, certainly not in any kind of business way. Maybe 10 years before he died, you know, I met him sort of socially, and that was really it. You know, we had, you know, one, you know, long conversation, but it wasn't about anything professional. It was just chit chat, talking about childhood and stuff like that.
Okay.
So 10 years later, then, you know, he dies, and a month or so after that, I get the call, excited and intimidated and all those things.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, I mean,
because even someone from you who's like, you know, you're an experienced author, you've worked, you know, you've got a good handful of published works under your belt. And then, you know, maybe I think even during our last conversation, you were, you know, you're kind of like, well, yeah, I always look for new ways to challenge myself. And it's right. Like, well, you put it out into the universe and the universe answered, I think.
Yeah, it was a unique challenge because what we were dealing with was a manuscript in pieces, basically. It wasn't like he had written X number of pages of the book and stopped necessarily. There were things he'd written that, I mean, that was sort of largely the case, but not entirely the case. There were things that he'd written that clearly belonged somewhere in the middle. There were things near the end. So it was a patchwork, sort of. And I had to spend... or I chose to spend months ahead of time before I wrote a word, just studying up on Romero. I'm already was sort of a lay expert, but I became a sort of an official expert. Watched all his movies again, watched them with commentary tracks, read all the interviews, listened to all the interviews I could, and really got to figure out, you know, anything I didn't know about him, his politics or his viewpoints on this or that, I was able to figure out. And even during the writing, if I had a question, I could call up his wife and sort of probe around for more answers.
Okay.
So, you know, one of the critical things was his wife, Suze, was able to refer me to a list of his favorite media, you know, his favorite music, his favorite films, so forth. And so I could study those works of art. And I thought that maybe because I didn't have George, I could sort of build a George AI sort of thing. So I could... If I could figure out what he loved about these certain films, for example, that he returned to again and again and claimed were inspiring to him, then maybe I could be inspired by those same things and use those to patch up the holes in the manuscript. And it worked. it was a weird idea, but it worked really well. And I was able the biggest example is Tales of Hoffman, which is this, it's a movie version of an opera that he was obsessed with.
Okay.
He was obsessed with it since he was a kid. He was obsessed with Tales of Hoffman in the way that I was obsessed with Night of the Living Dead. And he talked about it in interviews his entire life. So I studied that film, that opera, and I was really able to borrow a lot of structural cues from it. I adopted the opera's three-act structure for the book to impose some sort of structure. And then I used each act of the opera's – each act sort of has its own story and its own theme, and I used those as bases on which to build what I needed to build.
That's really interesting that you kind of had to like – you almost had to fish for inspiration, but you know, it makes sense that you started with – just kind of digging into what inspires him. I mean, that makes so much sense because if you're trying to create a work or finish his work with bits and pieces here and there and try to make it look like it was all supposed to come together cohesively, then it's like, how do you even, you know? And so, no, that's really interesting. I think that makes a lot of sense that you kind of just you use all the tools you had, including even diving deeper and trying to get into his brain, even though you couldn't speak to the man himself.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine even what was going through your head and the kind of pressure that you were feeling, you know, when you were approached with finishing his work. Like, did you say yes right away? Did you say, oh my God?
I said yes right away.
Yeah.
it's not the kind of opportunity I could ever possibly pass up. And live with myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, no one put more pressure on me than myself by far.
Right, right.
You know, the idea that this was sort of his final word on zombies that he had begun 50 years ago, a big deal for me, a big deal for a lot of people. And I wanted to treat that with the gravity in which I considered it, which, you know, may seem frivolous to some, but I treated it as if it were an unfinished Rembrandt or something. Like I really treated it like it was a very, very important piece of historic art that I had to both restore and finish.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So did you, and then you said, you know, you were able to talk to his wife, you know, to kind of when you got stuck on some things. Now, how did that go into like the editing phase? Like, was she a part of that, or were, you know, Romero's, any of his connections were a part of that?
No, not so much in the editing. Most of that stuff was front loaded. And I got all the input I needed at the beginning. That's how I tend to work, especially books that require a lot of research. I do really all of it up front. And then if I need to follow up with something here or there, I do that, but I generally front load. And particularly on this book that was, you know, was going to have a complicated structure, really overplanned. You know, I wrote a big, long outline. I don't know how long it was. It might have been 100 pages. You know, it was really extensive. Yeah.
And well, it is a long book, so I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, that's not even the longest outline I've ever written. I really go to it when I need to. So really the his wife and that kind of contingent didn't really come back into it until I'd finished a draft of the book.
Now that's cool. Because I wonder how, you know, that works even in the normal publishing phase. I know that it, you know, maybe there's deadlines you have to meet and it goes through what the reader gets in front of them is definitely not what you first submit, the author first submits. And so I thought that was interesting, like how this sort of unique type of project would have, you know, changed that whole process, like from writing, editing, and then finally, crossing the T's and dotting the I's. And
it was basically the same. I mean, the thing that sticks out to me most about that, the editing process, was having to cut a couple scenes that George wrote, because I really didn't want to cut anything. I really tried to maintain everything of his that I could. But essentially, when it came down to, we were working with numerous documents. We had his initial pages, and we sort of discovered later another big chunk of pages that were sort of related, but not entirely. They were from an earlier sort of run at the idea. Found this short story that had been lost to time, and then far into the project, we found notes that he had laughed about were some of the plot lines are going. So I had all these different factors coming in. Mm-hmm. And I did, if there's one thing in the book that I'm proud of, is I was able to find a way to use almost all of it in a way that I think feels cohesive and smooth.
Yeah. But, and then that's even after you found some more work to go off right? Like after you had finished so much of it.
There was a lot of like big idea thinking in this book where I just had to sit down for a few days with paper and pen and just figure out how it was all going to work.
Yeah.
But along the way, there were, you know, there were a couple bits that he wrote that I loved that just would not fit. So there's a couple lost scenes that I was really sad to see go because I just didn't want to cut anything of his, but it just didn't, there was no way to wedge them in that made any kind of sense.
So was that scenes between like, because I think you said that there were a couple characters that you had already said goodbye to, but then he didn't. And was that, is that an example? No. Is it an example of one of those things?
It's kind of funny. And there was, in the manuscript that he wrote, there were a couple, what looked to me as a couple of extremely minor characters. And then once I was hundreds of pages into the book and we found his notes, he had some note that was just sort of like, these two characters go on to have many adventures and I had already killed them. And I didn't know what these, what these many adventures really were. So I was like, all right, we're just going to leave those two dead. Because I didn't seem like he had too much of a plan for them anyway.
Yeah. He had tons of ideas and then you kind of caught it after the fact. But so that was an example of something that you were okay with letting go.
Yeah, that was fine. I mean, he clearly didn't have too heavy of an opinion on that one. He just sort of had a vague notion those people might love. Yeah. But they,
so what's in it? Can you give like, well, maybe it's hard to be spoiler free. What's an example of something that you really, you hated letting go?
Oh, there was this wild scene that is just, was just one of those bonkers things I'd ever read. And therefore I loved it. It was, it was a scene that took place in Africa somewhere. And that was one of the reasons it cut because the book is very America focused.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it just didn't make sense. I really tried and for a while I was in the book, but it just didn't work. And it's just crazy. But anyways, there was this, someone who is going to be harmed and this man comes into this, sort of like a tribe essentially and rescues her and they're being chased through the desert and their Jeep crashes and the man gets thrown into this creek essentially and the woman gets trapped under the Jeep. And I'm leaving out things that make it already crazy, but believe me, it was a crazy scene. And then she's trapped under the Jeep and the man rises from the creek. He's become a zombie and he's going to come out and kill her now, the guy who was saving her. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, all these hippopotamuses come out of the creek and attack and eat the zombie. And it was just the weirdest thing. Like I could never, in a million years, I never would have imagined
that hippopotamuses. Oh, yeah.
Attachment. Yeah, it was just so bizarre that I loved it.
I imagine because it's like, yeah, you know, a lot of zombie stories focus on the humans, but that's what I think one thing this book kind of added to it where that might have come from Romero's brain and maybe you built off of certain things that he had in mind with, you know, with the time jumps and everything. You see like the natural world, the forestry and the animals like kind of taking the world back. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, you describing that scene just kind of like reminds me of some of the stuff with either, I think there were some zoo animals that got out know, and it was like, yeah, you're not only watching out for zombies and other humans that show their true colors, but then you're also looking at the dogs and the lovable and domesticated animals and also the wild animals that we've tried to domesticate. And it's like, it reaches so, so much further. Like there are so many more implications in this kind of world would bring about that. It's like, of course, why wouldn't it happen that way? Like, why would it just focus on, why would humans only be? And then you kind of touched on that too, where when they were trying to figure out the rules, for the zombies or the walkers or whatever, the multiple, you know, I think they called them ghouls at some point.
Yeah.
The multiple terms that the characters come up with, it's like, what are, you know, cause it is an antagonist that you can't, or a villain, I guess, that you can't you can't reason with, you can't convince them or persuade them to turn over to the good side. Like you can't, it's, they're just very basic. And that's like what you're fighting against. And that's
Well, I mean, you're right on. And essentially what's happening is that they're not the villains, you know, that's sort of where Romero was heading with all this, is that the zombies aren't the villains at all. You know, the people are the villains, and part of the journey of the characters is sort of coming to terms with that and realizing that, you know, the zombies are something natural that's happening. And what the humans have done to the planet, more or less, is unnatural.
Yeah.
And there's the planet is self-correcting in a way. And that's, you know, to me in all my books, really, it's something I've been really interested in, is protagonists who have to realize that they're the antagonists.
Yeah.
And that's a tough, it's tough realization, you know, just in life, in relationships, you know, to realize that sometimes you're the bad guy.
Yeah. Or, you know, that's, there's that old, you know, it's a recurring kind of theme. It's like, you know, it depends on which side you're on, you know, like you're the bad guy in someone else's story. And, you know, it's like, no matter what, you think you're right. And so it's really, you know, you see that goal and you're convinced that it's the right and the best way to go about it. And it's, you know, you don't realize, like, or character might not realize that they're ruining everything. And like, they're the big problem. So, you know, obviously the zombie story, the zombie genre has been touched upon, and, you know, not only in film, but you know, graphic novels and TV. And so, you know, what would you say to readers or, you know, just entertainment viewers, like, who might criticize this book before even reading it, just being like, well, this is redundant. Like, what would you say to them to, like, try to convince them, like, no, it's, you know, to kind of, like, either convince them that, no, it's not necessarily redundant, or, you know, what would you say to them to kind of be like?
Well, I would not react kindly to that. I mean... You know, George Romero invented the modern idea of the zombie. So to call the inventor of something redundant would not make any sense to me. There would be none of this zombie stuff. None. Zero. If there hadn't have been Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, if you want to see how the man who started it all ends it, then... if you want to see how the story ends, then this is the book for you. He would have loved to have done this on film, of course. He was a filmmaker first and foremost, but he was never going to get the budget for something like this. Hollywood, do they like to tell him how great he was, but they never, ever gave him any money. So this was his chance to do everything he'd ever wanted to do. To go as big as he wanted to go as inward and as small as he wanted to go. He hated working with Hollywood and dealing with budgets being slashed. He was one of the unluckiest filmmakers I've ever read about. But he didn't have to worry about any of that here. He could just let his mind go wild, and that's how you end up with hippopotamuses jumping out of creeks and eating zombies. You could tell he was just like a kid in a candy store. He was just having so much fun with this.
Going for it. Yeah. No. And that's one thing I think about too. That's a good point where it's like, okay, if he'd started working on this maybe 10 years ago, and it's like, yeah, if he got fed up with the film industry and was like, you know what, I'm going to start it this way. I'm going to try it this way. And then who knows if he finished it, you know, sooner, even, you know, 8 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, who knows? Like maybe the world, I don't know if the world's burnt out on zombies right now. But it's kind of like they were hot for a while, even though they didn't, you know, it's like the real fans of it know that Romero's like the OG, like he started this back in the 60s, you know, 70s, 80s. He came out with a little bit of something like every what, like six years or so. And so it's, you know, it's kind of like, I'm going to be honest. When I first picked up this book, I was almost expecting to like see or read a lot of what I've seen before, but that's, I think it was almost just the tip of the iceberg. Like there was a lot that just in literature in general can offer so much more than what right. you see on film or on TV, because, you know, I love that the book started out with, you know, you're starting out with these characters, these separate characters, and, you know, at the start of the outbreak. And then later, you know, even though the book is so long and some parts are so like are kind of slow, it's kind of like you're still, it's still a page turner because it's still so character driven. And you're like, you know, you're the reader is left with, well, I don't know if I would have done that, but who knows? Like, I don't, this person's being a little dramatic or these people are being assholes, but it's like, that's the way of life. Like the world is full of idiots and assholes. And it's like something dramatic like this, you know, we're kind of seeing it now, even like with this whole pandemic, it's like something can trigger something.
Yeah. I mean, if you can't get people to put on a mask to control the coronavirus, you can't, you're not going to get them to stay inside or act or work together to stop zombies from coming in to you. I mean, they won't even put on, if they aren't going to put on a mask, they are not going to work together to fortify a house.
Yeah. You know,
it's not going to happen.
And it's sad. Yeah. Because then it's like, you want to hope for the best, but it's like when world order is completely gone, when society is completely like flipped upside down, it's like, who cares anymore? Like who,
yeah,
you know,
I just heard this story on the radio the other day that was about bystander syndrome and how if someone is alone and sees someone in need, they're likely to help them. But as soon as you add more people, they're likely to not help.
Yeah.
And I think Romero's, one of his great themes across all of his work was the problems of groups, you know, the problems of what happens when you bring groups of people together, they start working towards their own ends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He would not be surprised by any of the things that are happening right now. He predicted all of it.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's, and that's amazing the way that, it just kind of aligned with the craziness that's happening with 2020 and how, you know, we're kind of forced to, yeah, like you said, like either work together or everybody's screwed. It's kind of, you know, that's definitely reflected in this book where it just takes one asshole, one guy to speak loud enough to ruin or mess up whatever, like anything that anybody's been trying to do. And that happens, you know, there's that main asshole in your book, but then there's like a couple here and there that kind of, you know, throw a wrench into things when some of the characters are just doing their best to like survive. So who was your favorite character out of the whole lot that is in this book?
You know, I like so many of them. Probably the most fun for me to write was Etta. She's the, it's not really said, it's sort of implied she's on the autism spectrum somewhere. And so she has this very clinical way of looking at life and was never really into large groups to begin with. So when she, it's kind of like me in some ways. When she has to essentially quarantine herself alone in a building, she's as happy as she ever was.
Yeah.
and takes it upon herself just because she feels dutiful to start recording what's happening. People will, I won't get into the details of why, but throughout the zombie pandemic, people can call her on this number and they tell her story and their stories, and she writes them down. She becomes the record keeper of the new age. And for some reason, writing her came really natural to me. Maybe again, it's because I am certainly a something of a hermit myself. And you know, aside from just the mental strain of knowing what's happening to people,
sure.
My day to day work has been completely unchanged by COVID-19, you know, I'm very generally very happy just to sit here and write in this exact chair that I'm sitting right now.
No, yeah, I really liked Etta. I think she was definitely like one end. She definitely represented a large chunk of people, I think, and even maybe a side of people that they often refer, refer back to in terms of this kind of world, is that she's keeping herself busy, but she's very pragmatic, and she's very like, you know, no, I'm not, I'm fine with, you know, I think there was like four team members that left, that stayed the longest, and then they just left her coworkers, and you know, she was perfectly fine with that. Like, she was like, I don't, you know, I'm fine with being left here by myself. And then, you know, she went through and like logged all of her survival assets, like her food and, you know, the way it goes into detail about how she went through something as simple as like figuring out passwords so that she can start this project that she's coming up with. And I'm just sitting here thinking like, you know, that makes so much sense. Like, I could see myself becoming determined in a way to like either keep myself busy, or maybe I just haven't lost my mind yet. Maybe I'm just like, maybe it's almost a desperate need to like have some sort of purpose, you know, other than just surviving. But for her, it's like, it just made sense to her. That was just her personality.
And yeah, it's a way for her to just falls. It's her comfort zone, is to be methodical. Yeah.
No, I really liked reading her chapters a lot. So which character, if any of them, do you love to hate?
Love to hate, huh? Well, I don't want to say the obvious. I don't want to say the main bad guy.
Mm. Maybe hate is a strong word. Maybe it was just your least favorite. It's depending on the choices that they had to make.
I mean, I think I really like the character of Luis. He's frustrating in some ways. he's sort of gadget obsessed and a little explosive, and just, he's a little hot-headed, and if I found his actions occasionally irresponsible and a little frustrating, but I really liked him though. So, yeah. It's one of those rare books, because for a large chunk of the book, there is no specific antagonist. It's this odd thing where you have, mm-hmm. And this is, you know, the case sometimes with zombie works, where you have sort of minor antagonists, but you're against this faceless force. And it's just, you know, everything becomes shades of gray, you know. Mm-hmm. It was very clearly very important to George in his pages that all of his good guys had bad points, you know. Like, it was very evident that he was very into making sure that we realized that all of these characters were going to do stupid things and mm-hmm. frustrating things, and that they were going to right off the bat have problems. That they were not going to be always super easy to root for.
Yeah, no. And I mean, but that's the, you know, I think that's what one of the things that you and Romero did so well was just tapping into like the natural progression of like making decisions and based on your environment, based on your upbringing, based on your already prejudiced, assumptions of people or the world in general. And it's kind of, you guys tapped into that so wonderfully of I would say pretty accurately describing what these different types of personalities would have done. Even if, you know, if the world went to hell tomorrow, like I would probably be one of those fools just like locking myself in a closet. Like I wouldn't know like the first thing to do, but who knows, maybe something would click. You know, maybe I have no idea, because I've never been put in that situation. But then again, it's like, you never know, you know, if you see it's, you know, I think that was one thing with Charlie and Luis too. It's kind of like, oh, one of the first things they did was started boarding up the houses and only, you know, took down when they had to go out for runs and stuff. And I'm like, you know what, that makes so much sense. I'm like, I would be useless in like any sort of apocalypse, because those are things that I just don't, I guess you don't have to think about, because we've got that, the P word, people don't like the P word these days, but the privilege of, you mm-hmm. know, But it's true. It is like privilege of not having to develop those survival skills. And so that, I think that's probably one of the more fascinating parts of writing this type of book is that, you know, people in the U.S. are just, were, you know, depending on their socioeconomic status, they don't, maybe they do or do not fare too well.
Well, one of the things that he liked to do in his movies and he did in this book is that he makes it difficult in the sense that sometimes the bad characters are the ones who are helping good things to happen. And a good example of this in the book is Nathan Baseman, who works at the TV station. Like, he's a key part of the good that is happening at the TV station, which mm-hmm. ends up inspiring a lot of survivors out there. But he does some terrible things. And I think in most books, he would be a flat out villain, but he's the one making things happen for the good. And so you're constantly having to deal with that push and pull of, you know, here's a bad guy helping good things happen. So
yeah. Yeah. And that's like, yeah, but I think you're forcing the reader to be like, wait a second, do I like him or, you know, but
yeah. Yeah. And I love that kind of stuff. I mean, I love to be uncomfortable with my main characters.
Yeah, no, that definitely came up. And I feel like you had you definitely had a little sandbox to play in with this book in terms of, like, you know, having fun with characters and storylines and where, you know, where you were taking them. So I do want to be respectful of your time. So I'll just ask one more. Did you draw upon, I know we kind of touched upon this in the last few minutes here, but did you draw upon like any real life experiences or people that you know when you were like kind of writing some of these storylines or developing some of these personalities? Was a lot of it Romero's development and then you kind of drew upon your own?
Boy, like,
how did that go about?
I don't really think, I don't base too many characters on people I know. I would say 3/4 of the major characters began with Romero. Now that doesn't mean that some of them were very well developed in his pages and some were barely developed, but most of them began with him. So it was, you know, with any character, whether you're collaborating or not, you've got to find a way into them to be interested in them, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, the most challenging section of the book is the part that's on the aircraft carrier, just because I don't know anything about aircraft carriers. I don't know anything about the Navy.
Yeah.
So I had to learn a whole lot about all that stuff. And
yeah, you know, and you went into a lot of detail with that. So it was very well done. I was honestly really terrified during those chapters.
Yeah. Yeah. I visited an aircraft carrier. I mean, I went hardcore learning about aircraft carriers, because that was a section where George had clearly done his research but didn't finish it.
Okay.
And didn't leave me any, you know, I don't know what his research was, but he didn't leave it behind. So I had to start from scratch as far as just figuring out even the basics of what is, you know, Navy hierarchy and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what we were talking about, but
you basically answered it. You said like that you don't really have any, you don't usually base your characters off of anybody that you really know or anything. And then
I think what I was getting to maybe was the character of Carl Nishimura, who's on the ship and ends up becoming staying a major character throughout.
Yeah.
Like, he's somebody who I really had to figure out a way into. Romero had begun that character for me. And he was kind of this take charge, but straight laced guy. And I had to figure out a way, because he didn't get far enough into him that I could really sink my teeth into him, so to speak. And I had to figure out how do I understand this guy? How do I kind of love this guy?
Right.
Cause he's not demonstrative in any way. He's not a showy guy. So mm-hmm. he's a quiet character, and I had to figure out, how do I figure out how to love Carl?
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah. No, I liked him too. I think, no, him and honestly, I liked all of the characters, even the shitty ones, like the assholes. Like, I like, it's, you know, you did a really good job. Both you and Romero did a good job of picking apart and developing different, very different personalities and demonstrating their unique voices and their unique experiences and how, you know, their lives and their personalities would have shaped their actions and the choices that they were forced to make throughout the story. And then, you know, I love, like, minor spoiler alert, I love that we as readers get rewarded towards the end where they all, we see them interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's, even though like a lot of the action happens probably within the last quarter or third of the book, mm-hmm. I really can't see it happening any other way, really, because the first half, two thirds are just as crucial, even in between kind of the time jumps too, because of, like, I don't think I've ever read a book that spanned like 15 years. So that was,
yeah, it's it's got sort of a unique structure to it in that sense.
Now, is that your idea or that was Romero's idea, I'm guessing?
I think some of it was mine. It's all getting fuzzy now. there were things that he set up that, and some of this I go into in the author's note, that once I really thought about them hard and applied logic to them, I realized, okay, this has to play out over a certain number of years for this X thing to come to fruition.
Right.
And that was part of the fun and the challenge of studying his six zombie movies was figuring out, okay, if I fully understand points 1 through 6, mm-hmm. then I might be able to understand and predict what 7, 8, 9, and 10 might be, you know? So there was a lot of that sort of exercise, you know?
Yeah. Kind of like, yeah, you had a pinpoint and then decide. Right.
And
then, yeah.
And for reasons we won't go into for spoilers, it was important that he had set up, you know, I had to dig really deep, but there were a lot of zombie rules out there.
Yeah.
Some of them are obvious to us. Other ones I had to dig deeper for. But, you know, if you think about the opening years of the zombie epidemic, and then at what point will the zombies start to die out? At what point did the zombies not really have anything to feed on anymore?
Right.
And sort of die out. That's going to take, because of how bodies decompose and how zombies work, that's going to take a number of years.
Yeah.
So I had to allow for that passage of time.
Yeah, no. And that totally makes sense too. But I think literature totally, I think that's something that would have, you know, literature, maybe it's a little trickier to do that and to make it for the continuity's sake, because I think maybe in TV and film, it's easier to show, you know, with screenshots or whatever, but or film shots. But like, yeah, in a book, it's kind of like you have to explicitly state but then you can have fun with that too. Like, okay, what would happen 5, 10, 15 years? What would the world look like? You know, and I think, I think you guys nailed it. And I'm so glad I read this book. In my book review, I'm warning readers, it is a long read, but it's worth it. It's a page turner. I wasn't like, oh my God, how much of this book is left? It was like, yeah. Oh, okay. You know, so I enjoyed it a lot. And I want to thank you once again for taking the time and, you know, out of your busy schedule, believe it or not. But I imagine as you get closer to the release date, things are going to get a little crazier anyway. And then you've got the Teddies series coming out, which, right. I did get the first installment. So I'm going to get started on that soon.
It won't take you very long.
Okay.
It's really short.
Okay. No, are you got three planned or all three coming out or?
So I had four things coming out within 12 months. No, I had five things coming out in 12 months.
Okay, there you go.
but one was great. That 12 months began last October. So the first book, Blood Sugar, that was before pandemic time. So
yeah, okay.
So yeah, a month. So August is Living Dead, and then September is Teddy's, and then late September is the first issue of an 8-issue comic that I'm doing with Vault Comics called The Autumnal. And it's a,
I think I saw your post on that.
Yeah. So, and that'll be of course collected in a book when they finish coming out in the spring. And that's a sort of a sophisticated adult horror type thing.
No, I'm looking forward to it. You've been a very busy person, but you know, keep it coming. Like, I promise it will not continue
like this. It was a weird, it was a weird year where I had five things and none of them really competed with each other. They're all for very different audiences. That will never happen again. Thank God.
Yeah. I was going to say, cause I think the teddies are for middle school age kids, correct?
Yep.
They threw us away. Is that for middle school?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, that's good to know. No, I'm really intrigued by that, but yeah, but I think we're going to talk later about that when closer to that release date. So I'm looking forward to talking again. Thank you so much.
Hey, no problem.
For the conversation and for talking to me. And it was I'm really excited to get this information out and have our audience and, you know, the rest of your fans enjoy this work as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. And again, thanks to Megan and to Daniel Krause for putting together this interview. Looking forward to picking up the book here in August. Obviously, as you can hear from the interview, Megan got an early copy and she's a big fan. So you can find links to purchase the book and links to other works for Daniel Krause as well as all of his social media over at our show notes over at thenerdcantina.com/show93. Or you can just jump over to Amazon or whatever bookseller you have and pre-order this book. Again, it's The Living Dead, coming out on August 4th.
Yeah, if you have a local bookstore that you're able to access, buy your book there. Help them out. Like, they really need it.
All right. Well, with all that, thanks again for always listening. We appreciate all the support. Please give us a rating and review and join us over at the Nerd Cantina community. I don't know. I think we're going to figure out a book club or something here coming up with Megan, truly legitimate book reviewer and interviewer. And she is doing great on that side. And I think hopefully we can get some more people interested and excited about these books and these authors that are coming on the Cantina and sharing some conversations around them.
Yeah. And if you end up reading the book, if you read Ben Heavens or if you read A Living Dead, go ahead and go to the review, leave your comment, leave your thoughts in the comment section. Any interaction is greatly appreciated and keeps the conversation going.
All right. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next week, nerds.